Okay, it's August 15th, 2008, and we're in the National Park Service office. And could you please say your name, the people that are in the room here, please?
Sure, I'm Bernie Gillette, and my daughter's here, and my wife's here.
Jean Dolet.
Mm-hmm. And Jackie Dolet.
And I'm Janice Kozlowski. And is it okay if I take the conversation today?
Sure. Yes.
Yes.
Okay, great. All right, well, let's see, just to get started here, what was your first thing you remember about World War II?
Pearl Harbor particularly, but actually going back when Hitler invaded Poland in 1939, and I was about 12 years old. And it was a very serious time. And unfortunately, most Americans still remembered World War I and did not want to become involved. And so we really were a nation of majority isolationists, we call them. And Franklin Roosevelt, as president, had to find a way to help England. And he did a thing called the Lend-Lease, I remember that, where we loaned them equipment and money and so on to help them combat Hitler. Mm-hmm. The Canadians fought a lot. My family physician was a Canadian, and so his wife worked very hard with my mother, and they had a maple leaf organization, and they raised money, and they knit all kinds of socks and sweaters and scarves and everything, and sent it to Canada, and then that was sent over to England.
Do you remember people around your community doing that?
Oh yes. Yep. Everybody wanted to become involved in helping one way or another. One of my friends that I played tennis with later on and I didn't know her at that time, but I found out about it later, was a pilot, and she was able to relieve a man from flying the planes from Canada to England for the war. But things like that happened. Everybody had to find a way to pitch in. That was the deal.
Well, you were very young, so did you even have those feelings at that young age?
Oh, we talked about it a lot.
As a family?
In a family, yes. And I think a vast majority of people did. I mean, it was on our mind all the time. It was in the paper every day, the pictures, the news. We always went, you know, to the movies, and you had these PATH news, RKO PATH news with a rooster crowing, and pictures of the war were very, very tragic. And so you saw those as children. And so you knew, you know, war was a terrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the early memories. Later on, when Pearl Harbor struck in 1941, that, of course, I was home, and it was a Sunday, and my dad was listening to the radio, and he said, oh my gosh, you know, and he called us all in. We listened all night, and all afternoon, and all night, and then a long time, and couldn't believe, you know, what was happening, and it was a very, very terrible thing, and of course, the draft occurred, and they were mobilizing, and my brother was 3 years older than I, and he graduated from high school in 1941, and he went to college. Actually, yeah, 41, and so he went to college and spent a year, but after he finished the first year, he turned 18, and so he enlisted, and so again, that was another incentive to do more, and he served in Germany, went through the Battle of the Bulge and all that, and but he survived, and he did very well.
Was he in the infantry then?
Yes, he just in the old infantry, and he had some pretty good stories. But in any event, that's another thing. My mother, of course, after the Canadian, which she continued to do, she found that they had a defense school for men and women who were not going to serve in the armed forces. It was a night school, and she went to that first and became an aircraft worker. She became a tool and die maker, and she worked all through the war at an aircraft, at Columbia Aircraft, where I eventually went, because I was in the, what, ninth grade or something like that, eighth, tenth, when it first happened. And then by 1943, I was a senior, and that's when I decided that I could go to work, because I was 16, and I went to defense school at night. So it was from 6 to 11:30.
That's long.
Oh yeah, yeah. Every four nights a week, not on Friday, which was wonderful.
Maybe Friday's
Friday
off.
Yeah, they gave us Friday night off. And I had a neighbor friend who would drive me home. He was a teacher there, and so it was easy. But I had to, go to school all day, and I had to go an hour early because I had the two classes, and I stayed afterwards because I had the two classes, the history and the English.
What were the two classes for?
English and history to double up. That's 6 months from September till January. I had to take two English, first semester and second semester, and two American history, first semester and second semester. And
why were you doubling up?
So that I could graduate in January rather than in June.
Oh.
So it gave me 6 months before I went to college.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to work in the aircraft factory.
Was that a general practice at the time? That students doubled up and got done early?
Only for the boys. I set something up, I guess. We had a big fight with the principal and the superintendent and all the teachers getting hold of me and talking to me, you don't want to do this, you don't want to do this, and so on and so forth. But my mom and dad were very supportive if that's what I wanted to do, and I was adamant that that's what I wanted to do. And so finally they had to say yes. Because I started that earlier, before June was up, because I had to start in the fall with those double classes. And I don't remember exactly when I started the fight, but it took a little while. But the boys were doing it, and they were letting the boys do it who had the credits, and so they could graduate and they could enlist. Mm-hmm. Or before they were drafted, which was always better because then you had a better choice of the branch of service
right.
that you went into. And so they said, yes, I could do it, and I did. And it was great.
So then when did you start in the defense classes?
The defense classes, I started probably the end of October of 43, and I went through until, and I don't remember, they stopped probably the second week in December. And that's when I finished. And then when I finished my classes, which was in January, that's when I went to work.
Went to work where?
I went to work at Columbia Aircraft, the same company. It was in Valley Stream, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And they were building the J-2F, nicknamed the Duck. And they had been building that some time. It was an air-sea rescue plane. Had a large pontoon. And they could land, it was such a tough airplane, it could land in pretty good seas. And they took them, most of them were in the Pacific. And pilots who were shot down would wind up in those rafts floating around in the sea, and they'd finally locate them, and a ship would take one of these planes. They had them on the back of the destroyers, I think, or the cruisers, I'm not sure which, and then definitely on the aircraft carriers. But they had them, and they had a big crane, and they could lift them up and put them in the water, and they would fly off and find this pilot, land near them. They had SEALs or men who could swim and were dressed for the water to, if they needed to go get them. Some of them were injured badly, and they would, go get them, then bring that over. And the big pontoon had a door that opened up enough so that they were still very low to the water, and it was easy to bring the wounded or the flyer into the pontoon, and then off they would go and take them back to where they came from.
They put them in the pontoon?
Oh, yeah, because the pontoon was set up. The pontoon was not the kind of pontoons you look at out here in Alaska for the little float planes. Mm-hmm. This thing, half the plane was a pontoon. The whole bottom, I mean, it was big and narrow in the middle, and then the flight part was above that. So it was an interesting, tough plane, and did yeoman service. It was very good.
So it sounds like you knew a lot about what the planes were used for during the war. Did the company kind of tell you about them, or did you read about them in the newspaper?
I think I learned more talking with my parents. But I probably read a lot, too, because we always had the paper come every day, and I read that, but they didn't explain that kind of thing. We also, living on Long Island, with so many aircraft plants, we were, even from the 30s, I was always aware of planes flying overhead because they were around, and they were testing them and so on. The P-38s were made there, and we used to love to see them fly in their line. They looked like a ladder. The Thunderbolt was built there as well, the 47, P-47 I think it was. So we'd see them flying a lot. They were testing them too. I mean, you had to have them tested. The J-2F, they tested right there at our field. And in fact, my mother loved to fly, and she knew all the pilots. And the pilots, and they said, "Hey, you want to go for test pilot, my alien?" And she said, "Sure." And so she had several flights when they were doing the testing. So she loved it, and I never got that. They wouldn't get me. No, I never could get one. I was so mad. I was too young.
They didn't want.
You know, I was 16 when I was working there, and they were very protective. And I guess I was the only girl that
Tell
young.
Tell them how you got hooked up with Pete.
Well, that was that came along after I first. You know, when you started, you don't start out riveting. First, they send you for a bucket of propeller pitch or, you know, all kinds of, you know, they try to...
more menial chores.
That's right, mm-hmm. That's right. So you start out putting little parts together. And I started on a stabilizer. And I had the big, long, curved end of the stabilizer. And I would put it together. You had boxes that you put in, and you had to wrap a waterproof coating around it, and you had to put it just so, and it had to be in a particular area, because otherwise the drills and the rivets wouldn't be in the right lineup, that kind of thing. As long as you did it correctly, you know, after I did that for a few weeks, you know, you pass that one, they move you on to something that's a little more interesting. Mm-hmm. And then I started drilling holes in them. They had what they call a jig, where this would fit into it, and you'd clamp it in, and you went through all kinds of shenanigans to get it to hold it right exactly firm. Then the drill bit would drill holes so that later on that's where the rivets would go. And you learned all kinds of things with the tools while you did that. That was my second job. And then they said, okay, well, I guess we're going to teach you to rivet. And my mother, you know, I told everybody, and I, you know, hey, she had friends in every department, so she'd been there several years. See, she started working in 42. And because I didn't start work until 44, when I was 16, and she had friends all over. And
what did your mom do at the plant?
She was a tool and die maker. That's what she wound up being. And they have three levels, and she wound up the top level. She was very artistic, and she could draw very well. And she was also very mathematical. And so math was good and easy. So anyhow, she found a little old guy. His name was Pete, and he was a little short man. He had the biggest brown eyes you ever saw, and he was just the sweetest guy. A little heavy, but a very good mechanic. And so she lined me up with him, because when you rivet, you have a partner, mm-hmm. and you stay with the same partner, because you learn how that person uses the tools. And I handled the gun, the riveting gun, mm-hmm. but the hardest job is bucking the rivet, mm-hmm. and Pete bucked the rivet. And he could tell how my gun hand was going, whether he should buck hard or a little easier, because he wanted to get the rivets bucked just the same squashed distance for each of them, so it makes it, you know, uniform, and it's stronger. Mm-hmm. And so he was a great guy. He was very, very good. So, and he didn't allow any of the younger guys come near me.
That's your protector.
Oh, he was my protector, that's right. Because he had word from my mother, I know. I found much of this out later. Didn't bother me. I still could play softball with the gangs at 12 o'clock. Lunchtime, we had a half an hour off, and we'd go out in the yard and play softball.
So were there very many other women working at the plant with you?
Oh, yeah, there were other women. Yeah, quite a few women.
What, do you know what percentage of the plant was women at the time?
Boy, that's a tough one. I definitely was not half. It was less than half. That's about as good as I can say. I'm thinking of each department that I was in. And each department usually had somewhere between 5 and 10 people in it. And in each department, I might have been one of the gals, and there might have been two others. And I don't remember. When I got into the riveting and on the line, there were more women. I remember there were more women running the guns than there were men running the rivet guns. And I hadn't really thought about that much, but when I think back and look at the assembly line and where all they were and the gals I knew, and these were tough women, I'll tell you. They worked hard.
And was the company and the people that worked there, were they accommodating to women, or was it
different? They were accepted 100%. There was, as far as I ever knew, I never saw any discrimination or any put-downs of the women workers. Now, that could be that if a woman didn't measure up, they moved her into something that was an easier job. That's all. No, it was a time when they appreciated having the women working. And it opened the door for a lot of people to get into business or whatever, and found that they could do those things. Mm-hmm. At the time, you didn't even think anything of it, though. You know, you just thought, well, this is the way it is. We've got to do this. We have to win this war.
Mm-hmm. And, whatever it takes.
Yeah. It was a good time. I never got sorry. As I say, my mother worked 10-hour days, and I worked 8-hour days.
What shift were you on?
We worked from 8 till 4. I worked from 8 to 4:30, and Mom worked from 8 to 6. And so I'd just go out in the parking lot, freeze, read a book for an hour and a half until she was finished.
Were there very many other young people like you, under 18?
No.
And you didn't have any trouble getting a job there, it sounds like.
Oh, gosh, no.
If
you went to defense school and you did okay there, you had a job. I mean, that was it. And you could say which company you wanted to work for. I mean, that was the way it was. They needed us.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like your life was pretty busy at that time. Did you have any kind of recreation?
Oh, yeah, Saturday night movies. Actually, I had a bike, rode all over the place. We're living on Long Island. The ships coming out of New York Harbor followed the deep channel, which was parallel to the south shore of Long Island. And Long Island was pretty well populated even then. And the lights from all of the houses allowed the submarines to spot these ships coming out in silhouette with the lights. So what they did was they had what we called a blackout. Everybody had to put curtains on their windows. The street lamps were painted half. There was only a little tiny hole for the light to come down. Your headlights were half covered with black paint. You could not drive your car without that. You could not have big headlights. And air raid wardens went through each neighborhood and checked all the houses every night to make sure no light was showing, that kind of thing.
They actually came down your streets and checked?
Yeah, my mother was an air raid warden, too.
Wow.
And she'd go out at night and walk the streets.
Was that a volunteer job?
Or? Oh, yeah. All volunteer jobs. Yeah. But we had to do that because of the ships were being sunk. Now, Jones Beach is a very famous beach on the south shore of Long Island. It's a big one. It was about 14 miles from our house. And my friends and I, on Saturday or Sunday, would ride our bikes down there because we couldn't drive. We only had 3 gallons of gas for recreation. So you rode your bike if you wanted to go anyplace.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw the results of before the blackout and after the blackout. And the ships were sunk, and the oil and the debris, and even sometimes I saw a life preserver one time with the name of a ship on it. The only problem was, you couldn't take it home because we were on bikes and we had 14 miles to go. So, but we did see a lot of debris.
Yeah. How did that make you feel?
You knew that these people were being killed all the time. You're reading the papers and you knew these ships were going down and you just hoped it wasn't somebody that you knew.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did lose some close friends from high school. One boy lived 2 blocks down. He was a pilot on an aircraft carrier in the Pacific, and he was the golden boy of Baldwin High School. He did everything just right. He was a handsome young guy, very smart. Anyway, he was shot down. And oh, there was another one 2 blocks over, Georgie Moore. He was killed in the army in Europe. And then we had others that were fine, came back.
But so the war did hit close to home.
Oh, very close to home. Very personal. Came very personal.
Did you receive letters from Uncle Dana?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I always wish that we had the letters. I mean, I wrote to him regularly because they love to get mail. And mail was important.
Mm-hmm. Where was he stationed?
Pardon?
Where was he stationed?
Well, he went to Germany. He went to England. He started out, he was in Minneapolis, and at first they sent him to school, but then they needed him in the infantry, and they took him out and got him shipped over as they needed to get more and more trained soldiers. And because he had 1 year of college, it wasn't too long, he became a sergeant. But he was in England, I think, 6 weeks before he went over to Germany. And they say they worked. He was not in D-Day, but he was in the troops that came over afterwards, and he went through. And as I say, he was in the Battle of the Bulge, which was one of the big disasters that we lost a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. So he was lucky.
Yes, he was lucky. There's something about him. He was lucky because he could sleep through anything. And one time he was in a farmhouse upstairs sleeping, and it became the target for the artillery of the Germans. That darn stuff, they were terrible shots. They must have had untrained men. That's all Dana said. Had to be untrained because he didn't get his farmhouse didn't get hit. All the rest of the guys downstairs had gone out. They didn't know he was upstairs sleeping.
Uh-huh.
And finally he woke up, you know, and he came out, and the guy said, "Dan, were you in there?"
Lucky for him, they
yep,
weren't good shots.
Yep. It's amazing he came out of it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was luck. You just don't know.
And was the mail that you got from him, did it flow pretty smoothly, or was it a long time period?
It came sporadically. Usually you'd get 2 or 3 letters at a time.
And censored?
I'm trying to think. I don't think he wrote me anything that would get censored. He might have to my parents. But he did not talk a lot about it to me. I was his little sister, you know. And so, but I think he probably wrote more to Mom and Dad. And I really don't remember whether they had the censored letters or not. And I was away at school when he was there going into that. That was after I finished. I went to school in September of 1945, and
Was that after you worked at the aircraft factory?
Yes, yes. I worked at the aircraft factory from January till June, and I had a previous commitment to work at a camp in the summer, so I didn't work through the summer. And then I went to school in September. And by that time, things were beginning to look a lot better. We had D-Day, and we were on our way, going through. But Mom, of course, was still working. She worked for a couple of years after the war, too.
At the same plant?
No. After she left, they didn't make as many ducks after that. And so she had an opportunity to move over to Republic, and that's what she did. As a matter of fact, she worked for my husband's uncle. Just happened to be that way. We had never met then. We met in school, college.
Oh, you did? Not at the aircraft factory?
Not at the aircraft factory, no. No.
What school did you go to?
I started out at Sargent, which is part of Boston University, and I transferred when there was lots of legal difficulties between Sargent and Boston University, and it was a lot of turmoil. So I was advised by my high school teacher, who was really a mentor, to move over to Cortland State, which is a state school of New York University, and that's where we met.
Did the war have influence any decisions that you made in life, like what to study in school or anything like that?
No, I had made up my mind when I was in the second grade
what
I was
really?
Going to do, right?
And what was that?
Well, my aunt was a physical education teacher, and I love sports. I was in every sport I could think of. And I said, well, that's what I'm going to do. And so that's why I went to Sargent, because my aunt went to Sargent. But I happened to be there at a time of turmoil. It was a very serious turmoil. The student body hired lawyers, the faculty hired lawyers, half the faculty left. It was a very serious time because Boston University changed the rules, I should say. That's one way to put it. Anyway, it was so much turmoil. It's settled down and it's fine now.
Changed the rules about who they admitted or?
No, about the traditions of Sargent being carried on. Now, Dr. Sargent started this school back, early 1900s. I'm not sure exactly when. I couldn't give you that date. But there were a lot of traditions. It was an old school when I went there. And when my aunt went there, it was an old school. She graduated in the year I was born, 1927. The traditions were very important. But Boston University wanted Sargent to be a part of Boston University because they were given to the school was given to Boston University when Dr. Sargent died, and they wanted it to be Boston University, even though they had agreed that they would allow all of the traditions to go on, and that's what caused the hubbub.
Oh.
But they finally got it straightened out. But I never regretted the time I spent working there, but I never even thought much about it. You don't think that far ahead, you know. My mother told me, sometime you'll tell your grandchildren about this. Yeah.
Well, I didn't believe it then, though.
No, I didn't.
You're too young.
Grandchildren? Great-grandchildren? Nope, I don't think so.
But well, I'll give your voice a rest for a minute. I'll ask Bernie a couple questions.
Sure.
And what do you remember about the war years? What was your life like?
Well, my mother ran a boarding house, and some of the boarders worked at Grumman Aircraft, and some of them worked at Ranger, some of them worked at Republic. Republic came along after Seversky. Seversky started the company, and then it emerged into Republic. And I remember the day when they changed from Seversky to Republic, or if it wasn't the day, it was the week or whatever, when they changed the ownership. And it was a plane circling over. I lived a couple miles from the airfield. There was a plane circling overhead, and they kept circling. I said, that's not right. So I got on my bike, and I went up to the airport, and unfortunately, he was trying to get in for a landing. He came up short and hit the scrub oak, turned over, and he was killed. Mm. I had ridden my bike into the woods close to where it was, and I saw it and turned around and got out of there because there were lots of other people coming in there then. I heard about a lot of the things that Jane talked about because the fellows that all work there. In fact, I was just... she mentioned the J2F. Before Grumman moved to Bethpage, before they made the new plant over at Bethpage, they were up where Republic was built the Thunderbolt. They had a plant up there.
Do you remember what town that was?
Farmingdale, and it was in the 30s. And I think they moved in 1940 sometime to Bethpage. Anyway,
To Valley Stream?
No, they didn't move to Valley Stream. Valley Stream, Grumman started way back when. Grumman in a garage, actually. And he built pontoons before he ever had Grumman aircraft. But Grumman was in, had their plant in Farmingdale. Mm-hmm. And then they built a new plant over at Bethpage. And then, so when they were in Farmingdale, I could ride my bike up. And that was when I was by the doorway, and some of the boarders said, "You want to come in?" Sure. So I would go in and watch them work. And Jake Swerbel was the general manager. Jake Swerbel and Leroy Grumman ran the place. And they was, Jake's coming. Quick, get in here. So I'd jump into the J2F and get down in the pontoon. See, the big pontoon was right under the fuselage of the airplane. So it was the fuselage of the airplane with the engine on the front, and then below it was this great big pontoon. And the wings were out on the side with little pontoons on the edge of the wings. So anyway, I would jump in there and hide. And then they say, "Okay, Jake's gone, you can come out." So I'd come out, you know. But they were building that. And of course, during the war, all aircraft companies licensed other people to build planes. For example, Grumman allowed Columbia Aircraft, where Gene worked, to build part of the airplanes over there, and the J2F, and there were other places where they built control surfaces like ailerons or flaps or rudders or whatever, and in different plants all around the place, and then they'd bring them together and assemble them. And but anyway, I was involved heavily, and then my aunt, my mother's sister, worked as a secretary in the engineering department at Grumman. And they opened the new plant in the plant 2 in Grumman in 1941, the end of 41, and I went over to open house. They were building the torpedo bomber, the TBF, the Avenger, in there, and I went through the plant, and we came home. And got out of the car in the backyard, and the people across the street said Pearl Harbor has been bombed, and that was December 7th, 1941. But as Jane was saying, Long Island had a lot of the early plants for airplanes, and so they were around all the time.
She must have seen a lot of the test flights overhead.
Oh, I saw a lot of them. In fact, Grumman's forerunner to the Wildcat, the F-4F, which was famous in the Pacific and World War II, they had the F-3F, which was a biplane. And I remember the boarders coming home saying they tried a test, and he test dove it, and he was pulling out, and the engine and fell off, and the wings collapsed. And they said it's up in Melville, which was a little bit north of where the plant was. And we went up there and took a look, and of course there was this big hole in the ground where the engine went in, boom, you know. Plane went down someplace else out in the woods. But they lost the test pilot. But another one went in. A guy was a test pilot, I can't remember his name, my mother used to babysit for him. And he was coming in at Bethpage at the plant, and the one of the flaps collapsed. The plane flipped over, and he was too close to the ground to make any correction, and he went and was killed. But there was a lot of stuff around at that time. But
so how old were you at that time?
Well, I was a young whippersnapper. I was born in 28, so I didn't get out of high school in 45, yeah. I guess. I got out of high school in 45. But I worked in the summer, and I worked in Plant 2 in Grumman in the summertime, working on final assembly.
On what type of aircraft?
That was the F. It was a twin-engine plane. It was an experimental plane, and it never really worked on the carriers. It was a twin-engine. They gave it to the Marines to use but they flew it off the land. And that was one I worked on final assembly on. Before that, one summer, Anaglen got me a job.
Wasn't this the Tiger Cat?
Yes, Tiger Cat, yep. F-7?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. F-7F. Yep, mm-hmm. F-7. And I worked on that. Up inside, I put in the covers on the over where the gas tank was. They had gas tanks in those days that were I forget what the material was, rubberized something, and the bullet could go in, and it was called self-sealing tanks. So the bullet could go in and it would seal itself. And I put the covers on up above. You had to seal them up, and I worked on the nacelles on that thing, putting the nacelles around the engine. So forth. I had a good time. And I played softball at lunchtime with the department team, you know.
Yep.
didn't eat any lunch.
Well, that's right. As you ran to the field, you ate your sandwich.
That's right.
Did you make pretty good money there?
For that time, it was pretty good money. I don't remember exactly what it was, to tell you the truth. But
sure, I made more than I did.
We don't even have to ask that.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know. Maybe $35 a week, something like that.
Yes, a lot more than I did.
Yeah.
What did you both spend your money on?
The only thing that I really spent money on, I would go to baseball games and see the Giants at the Polo Grounds. So I'd buy a ticket on the Long Island Railroad and go into New York, take the subway up to, I forget, 100 and something street, and go to the Polo Grounds and see the Giants play a night game, come home, get the last train out of Penn Station for Long Island, which got in like 1 o'clock in the morning, and we'd get up in the morning and go to work. But that's just, you know, I don't remember spending a whole lot of money. Usually tried to save, because everybody wanted to save to go to college or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And
How about you, Jean? What did you spend your money on?
I had told Jackie this last night. I would get a check for, I don't know, $27, $28, 18 cents, 25 cents, 37 cents. Whatever was left over, I saved for spending money. The odd change. The rest of it went in the bank. And then if I needed a little more, hey, Mom, I ran out of money this week. You got another quarter. But I didn't spend a lot of money.
Well, quarter was a lot. Could you go see a movie for a quarter? Or?
Oh, yeah. It was 10 cents for a long time. Mm. I mean, and if you were under 12, I guess it was 10 cents. I looked under 12 for a long time because I was so little. But and even a movie was usually about a quarter, you're right. And that's when I would, very often, that's what I needed the quarter for, because you had to see the Saturday afternoon matinee. That was the big deal. But I didn't spend a lot of money. You know, you remember you could get penny candy and you get a nickel Coke. And a nickel Coke, if you asked for a chocolate Coke or a cherry Coke, it didn't cost you anything extra. They just put that soda in it and stirred it up. So it was very little that... My grandmother always had Coke in the refrigerator, and I cut her lawn, so, you know, I could go over there and get my Coke. I didn't have to spend my own money.
Well, that kind of brings up another question. What about rationing? Do you remember that?
Rationing was for sure. I mean, you didn't have much, or certain meat. You had meat tickets, and you had butter tickets.
and you only got that much, period. And so you didn't always have a lot of that, of meat or butter, which you might have wanted, but gasoline was, you know, 3 gallons a week for personal use. My mother had a B ticket because she was a certain number of miles, I think it was under 20, but more than 10, so it had to be somewhere around in there, to the plant. And so she got a B ticket with a certain number of gallons per week, and you had coupons that you had to give to the gas station when you were pumping gas, and you could get as much as you needed on that way.
So was that sufficient for people to get to work and the other things they needed to do, or did they
carpool? Well, they had to go to get to work. They either walked or, you know, they didn't want to use their gas. They either walked or rode a bike. A lot of people did ride bikes then, much more. It's too bad that they went back to the other after the war, because they just couldn't wait to get back in the car. But I still use my bike.
Good for you.
I live in a place where it's easy to do so. But there was a lot of rationing, but, you know, we were aware of it, and we had to be careful. But it wasn't painful.
Didn't feel like a hardship?
No, it wasn't painful. Well, you knew why you were doing it. Mm-hmm. And we got very upset when people cheated.
How did they cheat?
Well, there was a black market for coupons. And either they got stolen, or the stores, you never know what the employees could do to kind of lift a few of them and give them to somebody, you know, for money and that kind of thing. There's all different ways to cheat. I mean, as you know, and almost any place you go, there's a place for, if somebody's going to cheat, they will cheat. Unfortunately. But it's, I didn't know anybody specifically who did. I mean, I know my relatives were in the same boat that we were, as far as meat and butter was concerned. Those were the big things that were rationed.
What kind of meat did they give you?
Oh, hamburger, whatever you wanted to buy. You're rationed by the pound, I believe. I'm not quite sure about that. Do you remember? I think it was by the pound.
The ration was not by the cut of meat.
No.
It was not by the cut of meat.
So you could buy whatever you wanted to get. That's right. Mm.
But a lot of the cuts were not available.
Right. And
because a lot of them were used by the armed forces.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Remember, each person in a family had a book of coupons. And if you had children, you know, they didn't eat as much, mm-hmm. and so, or they didn't like it, whatever. So, that's why we never felt any real hardship as far as the ration was concerned. It was just a matter of planning, and it wasn't something we really complained about. Nobody that I remember complaining about it.
So, did either of you? How would you characterize your life during that time? What were your, when you look back, how did you feel about it?
Well, always in the back of your mind, you worried about the servicemen, your family, anybody that was overseas, anybody that was in hazard. But other than that, life went on. You went to school, you rode your bike, you had your fun, you saw the movies. You compared notes with friends who had relatives overseas. Where are they? What are they doing? That kind of thing. But I think everybody pulled together is, I think, the way I feel about it. It was a time when almost everybody's thoughts were, let's get this war over with. Let's do everything we can to make our soldiers be the victors. And we would worry when we had a turnaround or when things went bad or a battle was bad or a ship was destroyed or whatever. You really felt badly, but you still had everybody felt together. It was a kind of a friendly time almost. I don't remember anything that was upsetting particularly, other than if you heard of someone being lost. Mm-hmm. was great. One thing I wanted to add about the duck, it had wheels in the pontoon, so it could land on land as well as in the water. And that's why it was called the duck, because when it taxied, it waddled. It went like this. It was the funniest looking thing that you saw walking, coming off the line, because the Columbia aircraft, the testing was all done from a landing strip. And so we could see them go off, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And, but, you know, going out to the end of the landing strip, this thing, you know, and then, really, it went like this. You think that pontoon's going to break? No, not yet.
Well, that was a really appropriate name for that
yes.
airplane and the others in the line, the goose and the widgeon.
Yeah.
I mean, they all waddle like
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
so that was,
right.
those
that's,
were good
that's
names.
That's why they called them, yeah. So it seemed to me that there wasn't a lot of leisure time. I remember Granddaddy worked from when to when.
Yeah.
Your
yeah,
mom
yeah.
was working.
Oh, yeah. Not much
six
leisure
6 days
time.
A week that Granddaddy
yeah.
worked.
Well, Dad worked from, he worked in Brooklyn during the war.
Yeah.
He wasn't in Hoboken then, but he worked in Brooklyn. He took the train in. And, you know, he worked, he probably worked a 10 to 12 hour day. He was gone at least 10 to 12 hours, you know, taking the train and coming back.
Where did he work?
He worked in Brooklyn. He was a superintendent of a paper box company, corrugated boxes, and they made the boxes that they packed the ammunition and the guns and all of the rest of the, you know, all of the military equipment that had to be shipped. And that's but he had been there some time, long time.
What was your father's name?
Harry Chapin.
Chapin?
Chapin, yes. Lots of Chapins in New England.
And how about your mom? What was her name?
Her name was, her maiden name was Hubbard. Old Mother Hubbard, she used to call herself.
Jen, I knew your first name, Aileen.
Aileen. Yeah, I told her that before, but thanks.
Now, I understand that during the war, you know, they were, those aircraft companies, all of them were really under pressure to put airplanes out really quickly.
Oh, yes.
So, how did you feel pressured there to...
No. Everybody worked. There was not much slacking off. I mean, we had a nickname for them. We called them slackers if there was a person who did not work.
And then would they fire them if they were slackers?
I don't know. I you know, I wasn't involved enough to know, but... And I never got very close to anybody in the plant other than Pete and Webby, the guy with the infantile paralysis, the bad leg.
He worked at the plant too?
He worked there too, yes. Yeah. And I worked with him in the first department where I was putting everything together and learning how to drill and run the drill motor and, you know, sharpen the bits and all that kind of thing. But he was a nice guy. He was good. But he worked. I tell you, that guy worked. And, I mean, he had one heck of a gait walking. The one leg was a little bit shorter, and it was like a toothpick. And he didn't ever use crutches. And he had to walk from one end of that plant to the other many times.
What did he do there?
Well, he was the superintendent of one of our little areas. Or I don't know if you call him a superintendent. I don't know what they had to call him. Crew chief? Nope, but I can't remember what they called him. He was
foreman.
My boss. That's all I know.
They had foreman.
Foreman, yeah. He was a foreman of the group. And so he had a lot of walking to do. But you never heard him complain. Never heard him complain. Never him say, "Oh, sorry, I was tired," or whatever. He just worked. And Pete, gosh, I mean, we never stopped. We never stopped. 10 o'clock, he got 10 minutes. And 3 o'clock, he got 10 minutes. And it was like clockwork. Nobody took more than 10 minutes. And, but they always took their 10 minutes. You needed a break. You really did.
So there wasn't a lot of time for people to chit-chat while they were working?
Not a lot. It's noisy, you know, where you are. Most of, you know, something, I mean, the plants are wide open. So you've got departments that are kind of, they delineate it almost, I don't even think there was any paint on the lines on the floor, but you kind of knew where your department was. But there was one after the other, and some plants were noisier than others, depending on... You know, rivets are not silent, and the motors are not silent. No, the motors, the sanders are not silent.
No hearing protection, no gloves, no...
Women had to wear bandanas on their hair. They could not have... They had to have a bandana on their hair. And they had these special kinds. Mom was good at it. I never figured out how. She could wrap it around, and she'd have two colors, and she'd twist it, and she'd have this little braid across the top of her head. And I tried it, and it was a disaster. So I just went, tied a knot, you know, like Aunt Jemima.
I tried to keep your hair out of the machinery.
Yeah, right.
That's it.
That's why you see the posters of Rosie the Riveter with the bandana.
Always with a bandana on.
What about a uniform? Did you have a uniform?
Yeah, I did. I had a Columbia Aircraft uniform. We were coveralls, overalls, complete coveralls, pants, jacket, I mean, pants, suit, the whole thing was a one-piece thing. And Columbia Aircraft on the back. Oh, I thought that was great.
Oh, yeah.
I always carried them in the car. They were great because if you have a flat tire, you could put it on over your good clothes.
Keep yourself clean. Did the plant have a high security there, or did they take any precautions to disguise the plant?
Well, you couldn't get in without a pass.
So you had to be a worker?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Nobody could come in off the street and just go into the plant. And it was all fenced, you know, so you had to go in the gate and show your pass. And then you parked, and then you walked into the plant, and you had a ticket that was... In a bank, you've seen these time clock things, you know, you take the car and you punch your clock and you put it over there, and then when you go out, you do the same thing. So that's how they, you know, tell your hours for your paycheck. But Mom had a pass to get us in the gate. That's all. I didn't have my license yet, so I couldn't drive.
So they didn't disguise the plant from the air or take the markings off of it or anything like that?
No. We were not overly concerned about being attacked. It was a long way away from Europe. And ships did not have, even submarines, didn't have long-range kind of pinpoint. And we were, Long Island was, yes, it had a lot of aircraft plants, but it was a suburban community, mm-hmm. You know, houses and that kind of thing. We also had, over the Atlantic, dirigibles that scouted. Whenever the weather was clear, those dirigibles were up there. And there was a friend of ours who taught with my husband.
Well, they were blimps, you see today over the golf courses.
Yeah, mm-hmm,
okay,
right.
They were blimps. It's like a big airbag.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
And they scouted, and they could see submarines if they went down not too deep. And they never, as Bernie Henry said, they never sunk any ships when his blimp was up there. Never sunk any ships then. And those blimps really patrolled the Atlantic.
Mm. So you felt pretty safe?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I didn't. But we did have, the Coast Guard had the men walking the beach, because we had a big, long shoreline that was not inhabited. Long Island, Jones Beach and the Fire Island, this area was really not inhabited very heavily at all. Mm-hmm. And we did have sailors from Germany put ashore. But we caught some, and they caught some after they got to New York or someplace. Because they thought they had a good accent, but they didn't, you know. And they got spotted. Mm. They got spotted, but they did have that. But, you know, again, the incidents were infrequent, and I don't know. We didn't feel threatened. Mm-hmm. But we did feel alert. And I know we never went down the beach at night because we couldn't drive down there anyway. But when we went, they were always patrolled.
The aircraft wardens were trained to use sand to cover the incendiary bombs were used by the Germans on England. And so if we were going to get bombed and the incendiary bombs were going to be used to light fires, you couldn't put them out with water, so they were trained how to cover them with sand. And so your mother went through that kind of
training. Right, and we had buckets of sand, I remember that too.
Almost every house would have buckets of sand. Hmm.
I'd forgotten about that.
Stored someplace. So you were aware of it.
It's pretty close to home.
Yeah.
But, you know, you really weren't frightened because they didn't have the capability of flying across the Atlantic. They did not have the aircraft carriers, you know, that they have today in the Atlantic, like they did, like the Japanese had. So, it, you know, it was not particularly, not a frightening time for us at all. Mm-hmm. You never felt frightened. You just felt, we want to win this war. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to pitch in and do their part.
Was most of you, was most of the news that you heard from the European theater, did you hear much about the Pacific War or anything about Alaska? Did you know what was going on up here?
We did not know a lot about what was going on in Alaska. We certainly did know what went on in the Pacific. We got a lot of news about that. I remember that there was a time when Alaska, the Aleutians were attacked. At one, or there was some kind of bombing or whatever, but just only, I can remember very little.
We knew about the invasion of the Aleutian Islands by the Japanese.
And that was a...
And we also... But things in between, there wasn't really a lot of action there. So the action at the in the Pacific, where we did the island hopping on our way to Japan, got more coverage.
That's where the coverage was.
And but we did hear about when there was action up here. Well, when we went in to take back the islands from the Japanese later on in the war. Mm-hmm. But certainly the emphasis was more on, if we were going to be talking about this specifically, the emphasis would be more on the island hopping on the way to,
right,
or way back in the beginning, of course, Guadalcanal, and so forth.
Yeah, there's some big, horrible battles over there.
That's right.
And it lost a lot.
Well, Bernie, the plant that you worked in, was there pressure in your plant to work harder to get those airplanes out?
It wasn't so much the pressure of... the war effort was understood by everybody. So, you know, we have a war effort, and this is what we're going to do, and Jane mentioned earlier, you know, 10-hour days was the norm. Just everybody worked 10-hour days.
Yeah.
And some of the plants only worked 2 10-hour shifts. The third shift was used to bring in more parts or repair the machinery that had been needed repaired during the day so that they could continue production later on. Some places, though, did run 3 shifts, 10-hour shifts. 2 10-hour shifts and then whatever to get the work done. Usually the third one was for maintenance. But people just knew you had to work. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't work, you were gone.
They fired people if they weren't producing?
Oh, yeah. If you didn't work, you were gone. And remember, if you were of draft age, there's a lot of incentive.
Right.
That's right. If you were of draft age and were working in a defense plan, that was because the draft board, the local draft board, said, yes, you're exempt from the draft because you're working in a defense industry and we need the airplanes and you're a key person in this particular production. Yeah. So, you know, in the back of the mind of anybody who was of draft age, if you didn't produce here, goodbye, and where are you going next? You're going next in the Army.
Europe or wherever.
Yeah. Or wherever.
See, remember, they didn't draft everybody. Here's a block of young men, 18 to 27, was it?
Well, no, it was, in the beginning it was 45.
45, that's in the beginning. Mm-hmm. 18 to 45. Anyway, here's this huge block of men. Well, they can't take them all in at once. And so they all were assigned a number when they registered. And in each area, they picked up numbers. And if it was your number, you were drafted. And, so they didn't all get drafted. So while they weren't drafted, then they worked. And if you could get a job in a defense plant and become important, and needed, then
you that was your
worked pretty good. That was your contribution, and
well,
you
the draft board made a decision.
Right, the draft board decided.
You had these draft boards that would look at things and then make a decision. Say yes, this guy is needed at the plant, and we need the airplanes, and therefore he won't go into the Army as a private. He'll stay here as a whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you have women working at your plant?
Sure.
What percentage of your plant do you think was women?
It would be a minor percentage. If it was 30%, that would be about right, I would say. Mm-hmm. That would be my guess. Okay, a very uneducated guess, just from observation walking around. And in some areas, a lot more. For example, in the engineering department, where my hand was, most all the stenographers and all of the secretaries were women. If you get down on the plant where you have heavy work, most of them are going to be men, you know, with heavy lifting or whatever. And you go to another department where you have riveting, like Rosie the Riveter was very common.
So you see
a lot of women riveting.
A lot more.
And of course you might realize that the skin, the covering on the airplane was metal, and so you had to have a lot of riveters to put all of the covering on the airplane.
Sure. How did the men feel about women working down in the assembly area?
The usual bias was there with the men, and if they had a bias against women, they didn't like them being there, but they didn't have much choice. Mm-hmm. If they hired them and said, the foreman says, this is going to be her job and you're going to work with her, well, that's the way it is. May not like it and may grumble about it. But I don't remember a whole lot of remarks about dissension or anything of that type. You just worked alongside them and got the job done. So, now remember, I wasn't involved in hiring or any of that kind of thing. It may have been quite different over in that aspect of things.
Mm-hmm. And how about did your plan have any kind of security measures or disguises?
Oh yeah, sure. All defense plants, you had to have a badge in order to get in.
Yeah. You wore your badge.
And you had to wear your badge, you had to wear a badge, and you had to be seen. And you wore it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, you know, when you go into your part of the plant, everybody knew everybody.
Yeah.
So if there was a stranger in there, the word was, you know, what's he doing?
Who's that?
Yeah, right. And, but out at the gate, when you had thousands of people coming in, why, obviously, the guard didn't know them. He would just look to be sure you had your badge.
I don't remember any particular instances of sabotage.
No.
Do you?
If there were, they were not publicized.
Yeah.
But
we talked about
there were no bombings and that kind of thing that you see today in the Middle East or wherever.
Mm-hmm. And people then wouldn't have turned a blind eye to a stranger in the plant.
Absolutely not.
No.
Somebody that didn't belong in your department, somebody would want to know, or would go to the lead man and the foreman and say, what's he doing here?
Mm-hmm.
Or what's she doing here? And somebody would find out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you might find out that somebody was after a bucket of propeller pitch. And of course, if that were true, then everybody went along with it.
Yeah, right.
Sent them to the next department and then to the next department. Oh, we're just out of it. Darn, you better take your bucket and go down there.
Well, that was initiation.
Well, are there any other memories of things that or stories that happened during that time period that you'd like to relate? Maybe not things that I've asked about, or Jackie, can you think of anything that you talked with them about?
No, I think you've covered the gamut for that period of time.
My mother worked on airplanes in World War I.
Did she really?
And in Farmingdale. And I... When you were redoing your airplane, I remember mentioning to you, my mother told me about, she did the rib stitch, which I didn't know anything about, and we went over to the museum here, and the man showed us how he was doing rib stitching, and later on you did that on your own airplane. But my mother, in World War II, ran a boarding house, and she worked from 6:30 to midnight in a defense plant, and she worked with Uncle Eric down there.
You mean during World War II now, right?
Yep.
Okay.
And World War I, she worked, I don't know the plant or where, but she, I was always told that she was sewing on the fabric on the on the on the airplane.
But it was in New York?
And it was in Long Island.
Okay.
Remember, Long Island had Curtis, the plant where Gene worked at Columbia, I think Curtis Aircraft was there way back. Remember Curtis?
It was Curtis before Columbia.
Before then, and Curtis was there, and he's one of the pioneers. But, yeah, my mother worked in World War II. She ran the boarding house, made the lunches for all the guys to go to work, fed them breakfast. But then she worked and fed them dinner, and then she worked from 6:30 to midnight in the defense plant during World War II.
Wow. Which plant did she work in?
She worked in Farmingdale, and I can't remember the name of the plant at the moment. It was they built control surfaces for Grumman aircraft, ailerons, flaps, rudders. I can't remember the name of it at the moment.
Okay. And Uncle Eric worked.
He was in the same plant.
Yep. Yeah. That's your brother?
My uncle was my mother's sister's husband, Uncle Eric.
Kind of like your dad.
He was like my dad, yeah. My dad left when I was 11 weeks old, and Aunt Evelyn and Uncle Eric were very close. In fact, Aunt Evelyn and Uncle Eric came over and ate dinner at our house after their 10-hour day. And my mother would have their dinner ready, and then she'd leave at 6:30 or to go to work at 6:30. And then Aunt Evelyn and I could do the dishes for them and for the boarders.
And Uncle Eric worked at the Grumman?
He worked in the same plant that my mother worked in at Farmingdale, and they made control services.
He worked there all his life, though, didn't he? I mean, he was basically an aircraft.
No, he ran it during the Depression, which incidentally, you were asking about people spending money. Remember that just before World War I was a depression.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And
before World War II.
I mean, before World War II, mm-hmm. it was a depression. And most people were not in a spending mood. If you had extra money, I'm sure there were spendthrifts, but most people wanted to save somehow if they could.
Didn't know when that might happen again.
That's right. I wish some of my children would remember that. Not Jackie, she's already dead.
She's frugal.
No, she's the most frugal one of all. She's even better than I am.
What was your mom's name?
Mildred. Her last name before she got married was Piatt, P-I-A-T. Supposedly from somewhere around the border of France and Switzerland. And Dolat came from someplace around Alsace-Lorraine, so it depends on who won the war, whether they were German or French at that time. Supposedly. Remember, these are we had immigrant people that came in the early 1900s and thereabouts. Uncle Eric came from Sweden. His name was Carlson. And, he was a... by trade, he was trained back in Sweden as a carpenter, and of course, it just worked with tools, and then he got into the aircraft. I was thinking of that when you were talking about, you asked about how they spend, and you were mentioning, you know, it was 10 cents to go to the movies or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course, way back in the Depression, 10 cents bought you a loaf of bread. You can't get 10 cents
That's
a loaf of bread today.
No, not even close.
Not even close.
I don't know what you can buy for 10 cents anymore.
Not even a phone call.
Remember when you used to put a dime in the toll?
Yeah.
Can't do that anymore either, can you?
Your telephone, we always have a dime in our loafers.
In your loafer?
Yeah, your penny loafers? You always carried a dime.
Penny loafers, what you used to put a dime in the top
here. So you could make a phone call home if you needed help. Yeah, different times.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah. But, you know, each generation has different times, too.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that living through World War II had a big impact on your life?
I don't know, it's just part of living.
Sure.
It had to have made...
Absolutely had a big influence on life, yes. You know, if you live through rationing, you didn't just go out and buy anything you wanted to buy. If you worked in a plant, you had this thing. And after the war, they weren't quite so particular about that. It kind of backed off. And now, of course, we're back in that era where you're very particular, even more particular, I think, maybe than they were then.
Yeah.
The plants were surrounded by fence. And in the beginning of the war, they had a sentry post, a raised area where there was a sentry at the corners, wherever there was a corner on the fence, and they were manned at that time. But later on, when we had lived through so much turmoil and so forth, and they didn't have problems, that's where they took them away. They needed them someplace else. Battle of the Bulge, your brother was in training for I forget what, but they had people who were in pilot training at that time. Pilot training. They were in the beginning of their training to become pilots, and the bulge happened, and they needed infantrymen, and they just pulled them right out of pilot training. Put them on the boat and sent them over there. Mm-hmm. These poor suckers didn't have a whole lot of training in the infantry. Mm-hmm. They gave them a rifle and put them in there and said, survive. But they had to, And you learn fast.
Mm-hmm. You're forced to grow up a lot quicker, too. Those were young people.
You think about the pilots of the B-17s.
Yeah.
These guys were young kids, and they were
19
responsible
and 20 years
for...
old.
Yeah, you're responsible for 9 or 10 crew members and a huge airplane, and I mean, they grew up fast.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, and I think it's true. We did grow up fast. I mean, when I was 16, I felt I was grown up. I really did. I'm working, and I'm going to college for.
I guess maybe that's.
Comes, but
yeah, I think maybe that's one of the things that's.
I think that's the impact
that
of
that.
Anything.
That you grew up a lot faster.
Right.
You took on responsibility because you had to.
Right.
And that's a good point, Jane.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good point.
I never lived home again after 16 more than 2 weeks at a time.
Really?
Right. I'd come home on vacation, Christmas vacation, spring break. I worked in the summer. I went away in the summer. I'd come home in between the end of school and going to work and... I mean, that was part of it. I was independent.
I went away to school at 17 and never came home to work and to live again.
And then when did you two get married?
We were 21.
Yeah.
When we got married, 1949.
Finished with school?
Yep. I was teaching.
I
taught
not,
a year before.
I was
He
not
was home because he had been in the service and he went over to Japan with the...
Occupation
troops.
Oh.
And he had to volunteer. Because he could have still, the draft was still on. The war was over, but the draft was still on. So by volunteering, he was able to get a certain deal, whatever it was, I don't know. But
I volunteered. You could volunteer for 18 months, you could volunteer for 2
months,
years,
yeah.
You could volunteer for 3 years.
Yeah.
I said, well, if I'm going to volunteer, I'll volunteer 18 months and see what happens.
and
so I went over to Japan. We came into... to Yokohama on the troop ship, and there were still sunken ships all over the place, and the big cranes were on the side where they'd been bombed and so forth. And for the firestorms that the B-29 started that burned from Yokohama to Tokyo, burned everything out. The only thing standing when we went through on the train were bank vaults. And they made their chimneys not with bricks like we usually make ours, they make them with reinforced concrete.
Uh-huh.
And so there would be standing chimneys and there'd be bank vaults. The rest was burned out.
Mm-hmm.
And the size of their factories were made of corrugated metal. And so what they did was they blew out, you know, and what they did was they people took these and they made lean-tos, and they were living in under these lean-tos.
So they had left.
Yep.
That's right. And then we went up into a factory. I was in Division of Artillery in 1st Cavalry, and we went up into a place where they made landing gears for Zero fighters. This was a little plant. And we took it over. And here's this plant, a 20th century plant, and outside you saw the rice paddies, and they were cultivating the rice paddies just as they did 1,000 years ago. There was a man and a woman, and they had this rack with all of these wooden prongs on it, and they swung it back and forth like this. And on one swing, they lowered it and dragged the little pegs through the ground and cultivated the soil between where the rice plants had been put down. And then they would take a side step forward. This thing would raise up, run back, and then take it one through, raise it up, another step through, go up and down the ranks. And they planted around. There was a B-25 that had been shot down, crashed here, and they just planted the rice around.
Left it there.
So what was your job there? What were you doing?
I worked in message center. I always looked around to see what kind of good job you get, you know. I worked in message center, and they had this gidget that you use to try to decode things and whatnot and so forth, which we almost never used. You had to learn how to use the dumb thing, but we never really did much in code. We just sent out the orders and away we went. I was there during a flood. The river flooded and came in the gate, and they said, get your stuff, get everything on the second floor, everything you can. By the time we moved about half our stuff, the water was coming in the front door, in the windows. We got it all on the second floor, and so, but it went down in about a day or two. So message center, in the meantime, takes 2.5-ton trucks, and we delivered everything by hand around to the division artillery and all the other places that were stationed all around. It was interesting.
Did you have much contact with the Japanese people?
You could go into town if you wanted to, and I never did. I didn't bother going into town. I stayed on post.
Did you have somebody do your laundry?
Well, we had some people, Japanese, that worked for us, and I'd give them my laundry, and I didn't want to go to the army laundry, they just wreck your stuff, so I'd give it to him and say, how long? He'd say, ashta, which is tomorrow, in 3 days. We'd come back in 3 days.
Did they treat you very well there?
The Japanese, we had almost no contact with them. All trains had cars that were just for servicemen. None of the Japanese could go in there. And we used those so we could go around on those, which I almost never did. I went down to Tokyo. I called you from Tokyo.
Yeah.
had to make
a phone call to the sorority house. It came at 1 a.m. You had to make the appointment, what, a week ahead?
Well, you got 5 minutes, and you had to make the appointment a week ahead of time, and they would give you time. You can make your phone call at this time, and I forget what I paid them, $10 or $20 or something like that.
20-something.
And so I made the appointment, and I hitched a ride down with somebody going to Tokyo. It was 60 miles to Tokyo. Somebody was driving down there, so I hitched a ride on the truck. He was delivering something down there. I went down, made the phone call to you, and then he came back from picking up whatever he was picking up. I jumped back in the truck and went 60 miles back up.
The phone rang at 1 o'clock. Of course, the whole house knew I was in a sorority. Everybody knew he was calling, you know. The whole house came down the stairs. They were hanging over the, you know. But once I started talking, they all disappeared. That was something.
So how long did you spend there, the whole 18 months?
No, I spent, I spent a year overseas. I was on the troop ship in December.
Christmas.
And I went over Christmas, that's right. And then, and I was on the troop ship in December.
Christmas?
Coming
Christmas,
home.
Both times coming home.
Coming home.
Oh, jeez. You left in September.
Yeah. But,
What was your life's profession then? What did you do?
My life's profession, you mean after the Army?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm a teacher. I was a teacher. I was a physical education.
Started out that way.
And then I got my degrees and stuff, and then I went into the State Department of Education in Connecticut. I was there for, 23 years, something like that. And I ended up in administration. I ran the administrative part of the department. We ran 14 vocational technical schools, were under the state board in Connecticut. Mm. And so we did all of their budgeting and all their accounting and their personnel work all came out of sections under me. And that's what I did. And then I retired. And now I'm very busy with golf.
And visiting.
I'm on the golf advisory committee to the board for Sun City. We have two golf courses, and I'm on the green committee for the two golf courses. And I rate golf courses for the South Carolina Golf Association, and which is not planned. You do all the rating by USGA standards with lasers doing all the measurements and so forth.
Oh, about the greens and the...
You measure how wide the fairways are, how far from where the ball would land for a bogey player or a scratch player, and then how wide it is there, how far to the out of bounds, how far to the trees, how far to the water, if there's water, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Lots of. The team probably takes 2,000 laser measurements, and we do that in the morning, and we convert. After we do that, then we convert from the yards to weighted scores in a table. We do that all. We hand it into the USGA, and that's how you get your handicaps for the golf courses.
So you're the guy, huh?
Yeah, I'm the guy. I'm the guy that starts it off, anyway.
Were there any other memories of the wartime that you wanted to relate?
You pretty well asked good questions.
Yeah, I think you did.
Probably exhausted by now, huh?
bringing a lot of memories back.
Yeah.
Some of them, they're kind of suppressed when you haven't talked about them, but then you all of a sudden you realize, it was there.
I guess one of the things you didn't realize at that time, because we were with airplanes, we didn't realize how many guys were killed bombing Germany. About 20% of the guys in the Air Force, in the 8th Air Force, that went over Germany bombing, never came back. 20%. That's 1 in 5, your chances of not coming back. That's pretty hard. We knew people that didn't come back. That's the way it is. But it's funny how adaptable human beings are. It's amazing how adaptable. You can live in almost any conditions, and somehow or other survive. Now, some people don't survive as well as others. Some people dwell on the negative. But I don't know about you, but in the people that I, most of the people that I knew were not depressed. You might be unhappy about something, but it's not something that's going to dominate how you feel inside. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing how pliable human beings are.
You're adaptable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. we haven't experienced that since World War II. We have not been united as a country like we were then. And unfortunately, I don't think we've had the leadership since that time.
I'm sure you've had it said before, too, that if you lost a serviceman, there was a gold star in the window. You've heard of all of that, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was something that if you drove by somebody's house and you saw that, you just had to, you know, ache for them. Mm-hmm. But if you had a son or a relative in the service, you didn't have a gold star, you could put up, what could they put up? There was something you could put up.
I don't remember.
It was a blue star?
I don't remember. I remember on the, in the front of
it. Let them know that you had somebody in the service.
If your plant made its production schedule.
Oh, yeah, you got an E for excellence.
You got an
right.
Army Navy E for excellence.
Yeah.
You could have.
Oh, that was always great. You could fly that from your flagpole.
It was a big pennant that you could fly out.
Above the plant?
Above the plant. Big pennant that you could fly out there in front of the plant.
Yeah.
And it was very important to have an Army Navy E for excellence.
That's right. I forgot. That's one of the things that brings up that. They made the shells down about a mile from our house, and they got an E for excellence.
Yeah.
That was a big plant that was down on Wilburn Avenue, because you don't know Walden, but down there they made the shells.
Baldwin, New York?
Baldwin, Long Island, New York, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was the company's name, do you remember?
I don't know. They made the shells of it.
Well, the big
artillery. Ones that...
You realize that at that time, with the way things were going, they would just come in and say, we need to use this facility to make something.
Right.
And they would take it over. Now, for example, when I went down with Bill Kummerfeld to Linden, New Jersey, which was an automobile plant for General Motors, I believe. And that plant was taken over, and they built Grumman Aircraft. They were licensed to build the F-4F. Then later on, I guess they did the F-6, I'm not sure. They did the F-4F anyway, which is a Wildcat. Mm-hmm. They were licensed to do that, and they built them down there. And so Grumman had its plant, and it was building airplanes, but we needed more planes than they could make, so they took this automobile plant and just turned it into an aircraft plant. And people were there, they had the skills, and so you just instead of making wheels for an automobile, you made wheels for an airplane or whatever.
Mm-hmm. They did the same with where they made the shells, and I can't remember what they made before they made the shells.
Yeah.
I was really little when they had that thing.
Well, it gives you an idea of how united things were.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
You just said, we need these, took it over, and people changed production or whatever they were making. It's amazing.
No quibbling about it, just do it.
That's right.
And people accepted it and said,
I
mean,
that's going to help, good.
Don't get me wrong, there were negotiations that went on all the time about, you know, all right, what are you guys going to pay us, you know, or how are you going to fix the plant up when you leave, or whatever. You know. But it happened. There was no question about it. We're going to build planes there. We're not going to build automobiles there, we're going to build planes there. Okay.
I think you could talk to anybody who lived through it, would know exactly what they were doing on December 7th afternoon. They would know exactly where they were. I don't think I've never talked to anybody who didn't know what they were
doing.
When
they got the news.
When we got the news, you know, everybody had that same kind of experience. Same with D-Day. When D-Day happened, because we knew that was coming. We didn't know just exactly when. But when they did it, we said, oh boy, finally we're going to get into Europe. And then what a job those guys had.
We lost a lot of people.
How quickly did you hear about the casualties after D-Day?
Pretty often. Pretty often.
The coverage was there was a lot of secrecy, naturally.
Yeah,
but,
right.
The coverage on casualties was not kept secret the way, unfortunately, it is kept secret today, where you can't take pictures of bodies of people coming back from the Middle East via presidential order and that kind of thing. It's there was naturally some things that were secret and wouldn't get out. But we knew there were going to be heavy casualties going in, and we had reporters going in that would say, you know, I'm with such a, I'm here, and we have heavy casualties. He might not tell you exactly how many, but he'll tell you heavy casualties. Or we were lucky, we're light, we got in, and we're on the high ground, or whatever.
But,
and it would be reported. But of course, it wasn't television; it was radio.
Mm-hmm. But we had the news of Dunkirk.
Oh, yeah.
With all of the ships coming across the canal, with a rescuing as many as they could, when we had that huge retreat, and everybody who had a boat in England
went across the English Channel.
I mean, they had little dinky boats and big boats and sailboats, everything they could take, everything that floated, went over there to rescue these soldiers who were being beaten back into the water. And they say that was an amazing rescue. But we saw the movies of it in the PATH News, in the movie theater.
Movies. It was common to go to the movies on Saturday night.
Yeah.
And so there was a, there were moving pictures of the battles and the news in the theaters.
Before the movie.
And that was regular.
Always got that.
And it was only maybe a week late?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Very good. They didn't keep it quiet. I'm sure they censored some of the things, but we saw a lot. We had a pretty good idea of what was going on. And I think that's part of what made people pull together. They saw how bad it was. They needed the help. They needed everybody to work as hard as they could. Mm-hmm. I mean, that Dunkirk was an absolute disaster turned into a success, because they saved so many troops that would have just been taken prisoner or killed. These people who had these boats, that must have been some expedition.
Yeah.
I mean, and with the pictures of it from the air, I mean, the whole place was filled. Well, you tell me that the Kenai River gets filled with fishermen.
Nothing like that, though.
Oh, it had to be. I mean, you know, wall-to-wall boats practically going across to save these guys. Mm-hmm. Some boats could only take 4 or 5 soldiers. So, mm-hmm. Hey, there's 4 or 5 that didn't die.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just an amazing thing. The English even came together, I think, even more than we did, if you can say so.
Mm-hmm.
What they did.
We're telling you about how it was around us.
Yeah.
The politics of the time were still divided with the isolationists of the Midwest, part of the United States, who did not want to go to Europe and fight a war. They remembered World War I, and they didn't want to get involved. And so, politically, when you think of the times, there were people who were against the war, and against our getting involved, particularly in the beginning, through the 30s and the early 40s. But once Pearl Harbor came along, there became a big turnaround. You still had people in Congress that were against it, but the vast majority, even politically, turned around at that time.
Yeah, that upped the ante considerably.
It sure did. It sure did. People understood that. And especially then, right after Pearl Harbor, when the British were going to have the great navy, and we took the 2 big battleships, the Japanese sunk the 2 big battleships of the English down in the Southwest Pacific, and knocked them off with the aircraft carriers, and of course that changed the whole complexion of warfare in the Navy, where the carrier became the capital ship and not the battleship of World War I and prior to that. And we lost island after island after island. The Philippines went, Corregidor, with MacArthur getting out of there, and we going to Australia, and we lost a lot of the stuff until we got down into New Guinea, and then things began to stop. But even there, they got some of the major ports in New Guinea that the Japanese took. And then we had to start working our way back up. Vosburgs, one of the boys, one of the Vosburg boys was a coxswain on a landing craft. So, you know, you go through one island invasion, and that one's over, you're still a coxswain on one of these things, and you got another island to do. And when you do that one, you got another island to do, and you just work your way up.
And hope you're not one of the ones that gets blown up.
That's right.
Yeah, they saw a lot of that for sure.
And they come home, they would get leave after an invasion, and they may get leave to come home, and they would tell people in town about what they did and what it was like and how many people they lost and was it a successful thing or did they screw something up or whatnot. They would be very open about telling people about it.
Anything else come to mind?
You've done a very good job, I think. Yep.
Well, I didn't. It
drawing
was you two.
Drawing us out. You drew us out very well.
It's always interesting to think back on it. You don't really get a chance to talk about it much. You don't think about it. But that's just part of your life. Mm-hmm. You'll find out.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time out of your vacation to do this.
Well, this has been very interesting.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's a good, good, good.